last two evenings that I've been here, I've spoken about the heart of ethical practice, that is the practice of non-harming. And we've looked at it in a number of different ways, and I pointed to the centrality of non-harming for our practice, and the centrality of ethical practice, and also pointing to how it's sometimes neglected or not seen as so central, that we often have the center on meditative practice. And yet, both traditionally and in terms of the contemporary world, focusing a significant aspect of our practice on non-harming seems very crucial. That there are all sorts of slow motion and fast motion forms of harm occurring in the world. We could see that. You know, a lot of which are, you know, will only slowly have their impact on the world. And I also mentioned how the practice of non-harming is both about refraining from harm, but also, more positively, about cultivating goodwill, kindness, compassion, as well as creating situations where there'll be less harm. So in the first talk, I gave the basic framework, and I also suggested five ways of practicing non-harming, five core ways of practicing non-harming. The first was working with intention, the reminding of oneself of this core practice, to bring intention into one's daily life in terms of the practice of non-harming. I also identified a second way of practicing non-harming, which is to guide one's behavior. In other words, to use that intention not to harm as a guideline that one brings into moment-to-moment practice. So you can ask, just to ask the question, will this harm? Is this harmful? Is this helpful? Can make a difference, you know, just asking that question. A third kind of practice brings in mindfulness and invites us to cultivate mindfulness when there seem to be moments when we might be violating the precept or about to violate the precept or in some ethically ambiguous territory. And again, there are a lot of ways that we can practice, but it's just really to investigate how our minds are. What's going on? What are my thoughts? What's my body feel like? What are my emotions when we're in that territory where we may be harming or getting close to harming? And then a fourth way of practicing is related to what I said earlier, that we can also practice more positively to cultivate kindness, compassion, as well as refrain from harming. So the fourth practice is actually having a dedicated heart practice like loving kindness or compassion. These all are great contributions to less harming in the world and having our own being be like a center of non-harming. One of the ways that the practice of non-harming is talked about a lot in the traditional text is that we become safe. That in a way we are, people do not need to fear us. That's a result of ethical practice. They don't need to, they still might. Right, that's based on their own conditioning, but in terms of picking up accurately cues about our tendencies to harm, when we practice non-harming, those cues are not there. And that's pretty significant. They become like safety zones, walking safety zones. And then the fifth kind of practice I suggested was to attend, given the precariousness of our world, to see where we each might be called in terms of addressing social harm, just to raise the question, since a lot of people want very much to do something, but they don't know what to do. Many of us do not know exactly what to do. And then the second talk, I continued with my Buddha-inspired penchant for lists. And so came up with 10 further ways of deepening our practice of non-harming. And I promised to get these on the website, which I have not yet done. But I thought I'd mention these just in passing. The very fundamental way to deepen is just to have greater duration for our ethical practice. So take something like that list of the 5 practices. And by the way, I didn't say necessarily do all 5. Do 1 or 2. See what you're really called to do. And that really goes for tonight. See what resonates. See what you'd like to do. And there's something really valuable by the that comes when we have our practice having some duration. So we have a month of every day thinking, how can I practice ethically? How can I practice non-harming? That's when things change. Because you do it for a month, it gets in your neural pathways. Or another way of saying it, you establish neural pathways. Non-harming neural pathways. NHNP, to use the technical term. And you can, and so simply the duration is a wonderful way to deepen. Just to do one thing, one kind of practice, but do it for a while. And so it gets in your mind, and it really can, once that you do it for a month, it gets almost into your intuitive nature. It's a lot of how practices work. A second way that I pointed to was looking at any ways that we might actually harm ourselves. To examine that. Are there ways I harm myself in obvious and less obvious ways? And to ask that question. You can also connect that with doing more loving kindness for self. Remembering that powerful passage from the Buddha where he says, one who loves oneself will not harm another. I would add, will not harm oneself. One who loves oneself will not cause harm. Pretty strong statement. So we could just teach love of self, and it would have a big impact. And you know, so much of harm and violence occurs when, for various reasons, including injustice and violence and trauma, people do not love themselves, and they're okay with harming others as well as themselves. Even the research on terrorism shows that one of the causes of terrorism, main causes, is a sense of humiliation, often connected with foreign conquest. Right? So a third related way of deepening is to have a heart practice that you do every day. It goes a long way. And then the fourth was more connected with study. Study the teachings on ethics. Study books like those by Thich Nhat Hanh or other writers on ethics. Or again, in my book on engaged practice, I have several chapters on ethics. A fifth practice is have a commitment to non-harming in your family and work situations. And maybe even help to have formal agreements in those settings. A sixth is to really focus on skillful speech. That goes a long way. Non-harming in speech. Make a commitment there. That's a big one, right? Seventh one I gave was shift to a plant-based diet. I think that was the only actual concrete behavioral suggestion he gave. Do this. Shift to a plant-based diet has a huge impact, both in terms of harming animals and in terms of harming the climate. You know, as many of you know, that as much as 50% of greenhouse gases come from the raising of livestock. rather shocking statistic, isn't it? It's well supported by evidence. The eighth, and these are more social dimension, look at your own attitudes and study your own mind in relation to four attitudes that cause harming, particularly socially conditioned, internalized ways of being, of having tendencies towards racism, homophobia, ageism, going against particular religions and so forth. We all have internalized that. And doing the work to look at that is important and powerful. And I mentioned last time how probably the most widespread internalized negative message is about the elderly, including by the elderly. Right? And they found a correlation between negative internalized views of the elderly and the tendency to develop Alzheimer's. So that eighth is to take on that commitment to work with your own mind around one of the internalized negative messages. And best probably to do that with others, so you can talk about things honestly. Number nine, study the nonviolence of Gandhi, King, and others, Dorothy Day. And number 10, commit to one way that you will devote some time every week to reducing some kind of social harm. Just one, one area, and commit to that. And so this evening, more deepening of non-harming practice. So I'll give some more possibilities that really connect with what I said earlier. And here I want to particularly talk about the intersection of ethical practice, meditation, and wisdom. And how when we take that relationship and really work with it closely, it's a major way to deepen our ethical practice. That's what I'll focus on. In other words, the ethical practice isn't just about not doing certain things or following certain rules, but it becomes this deeply rooted way of really moving on the path in which ethics, meditation, and wisdom are deeply interrelated. So that's what I want to focus on. But first I want to just see if there are any observations. How many of you gave significant attention to ethical practice and non-harming in the last week, as I invited? Great. Let me take maybe, 4 or 5 minutes just to see if anyone wants to report any observation or any question that came out. I'll take some notes. Maybe I'll weave what people say maybe into the rest of my talk. Anyone, we can use the mics. We need someone to help us. And anyone like to share something of what you found, an observation, an insight, a question? Mary, please.
She's working on it.
Okay. Why don't you say it and I'll repeat it.
Okay. My question is just a real technical one. You mentioned nonviolence in Gene Sharp.
Yeah.
That's what I, which book?
Okay. So the question about the book by Gene Sharp, where he gives 198 ways of nonviolent action. And it's a 3-volume collection, and I think it might be called a handbook of nonviolent action, but if you look up SHARP and look up a 3-volume collection, you'll find it. Okay? Other observations or questions? Yeah, and again, if the mic's not working out, I can repeat it.
Almost certainly. Just talk loud.
So why don't you go? Let's.
Here we go.
Okay, very good.
Over the last 3 weeks, I've been spending a lot of time with my family.
Yeah.
And there's 6 of us siblings.
Yeah, wow.
And we were all together for our family wedding, and then some issues regarding my mother's care, who's 100, came up, and I immediately saw these hurts that came up that had never been resolved.
Yeah.
Some old, some, you know, not so old, some from when we were adults.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, is there any way of doing, like in South Africa, where they did the reconciliation?
Yeah.
Have you seen that done where a family can do that and just say, yes, this hurt was here, and now we're just going to put that down and go on? Because I...
Yeah, so ways of acknowledging and transforming hurt in the family context. How many can relate to that question? Right, so thank you for naming that. So it's a really something I haven't focused on so much, even though it's been important to me personally. And maybe I'll weave that in, but the short answer is if there's a sincere will to have reconciliation, there are a tremendous number of things which can be done. Sometimes one needs skilled facilitators, mediators, people to help, but without the will and the intention, it's limited.
I was just wondering if you knew of any, or maybe some of our therapists do know of any kind of book or a therapist who actually, you know, has set out a pattern of, is this just how you go about?
Yeah, I think there'd be a lot of people one could talk to. I can think of a few people I know, but why don't we work that into
thank
the
you.
Discussion? And I sometimes have been a guest at the at a group of psychotherapists and lawyers who do mediation work, right? And I think I would know who to ask. And I have another person I know who does that kind of work as well. So we can, and there probably are wonderful books. Yeah, maybe one more question. So let's wait till the microphone comes.
To that question about siblings, my brother and I have a pattern of behavior. I mean, I love him dearly and he loves me, but we have a pattern of behavior that goes all the way back to when we were small children of competition, snarky speaking to each other, demanding. And I get into it, he gets into it, we don't even know that we're into it until after it's already there. It's so ingrained. And then all of a sudden, when the conversation's over, I'm thinking to myself, why do I continue to do this? And it's just, it's like not touching the fire, or it's not, it's like taking one step in front of the other.
Right.
It's so ingrained.
Yeah, let's look at that in the discussion time. Because, yeah. So I mostly wanted to get a sense of what people had explored, but that's huge, right? Yeah. Does anyone else have a brief sharing about something that you noticed? You know, up front? We'll come back to, I took some notes, so we'll come back to that. And I'll try to weave in some to your, right, to your, yeah. And I'll try to weave in, you know, some ways of bringing that up for you. Yeah.
Well, of course, ever since I took the judgment class,
yeah.
Judgment is something. But I've really tried to pause before I speak.
Yeah.
This week.
Great.
It's one of my intentions anyway, but I think since your talk, I've really, really tried to do that.
Yeah.
Because I'm aware sometimes that even my humor,
yeah,
is judgmental. It's not, doesn't. I've really been trying to look at speech.
That's great. Speech is such a wonderful handle. Of course, it's it can really help. It can be both diagnostic, and it can also, we can decide I'm not going to speak if there's something that might be harmful. We still like questions that Linda and Lucia brought up about, you know, the roots of family stuff. Practicing skillful speech won't necessarily get to the roots of that. but it's very helpful.
I found that if I think about it, the other person doesn't necessarily care what I'm saying anyway, and I don't need to say it.
Yeah. So speech practice is absolutely fundamental, certainly for families. Great. So thank you for that, and I love the fact that a good chunk of the group has really remembered the practice of non-harming, and you know, there's certain energy coming from the San Rafael area that's very evident, been reported in the news a few times. I use the microphone, but be brief, because I want to move on.
What I also realized is that when I don't say anything, and I'm not harming, I feel better.
Yes. Pausing and sometimes choosing not to speak, very, very helpful. Yeah. So the focus today is on this interconnection of ethics and meditation training and wisdom training. And I've mentioned both times, I think, that this is actually the way that the Buddha conceived of the general training. That it has these three core areas: ethical practice, meditative practice, and the development of wisdom. And that you can even see in the, you know, a fundamental way of understanding the Eightfold Path, which is the practical path of transformation, is that you have the first two factors of the Eightfold Path, usually translated as right view and right intention, representing the wisdom training. Then you have three representing the ethical training, having to do with speech, having to do with right livelihood, and having to do with what's usually translated as right action. And again, you probably remember from past talks, I don't like to translate the word sama, which is usually translated as right. I like to translate it as mature or realized, because it's related to words like summary, sama. And in any case, and then the last three having to do with meditation, usually translated as right effort, especially the effort to be aware, right mindfulness, and right concentration, usual translations. And very similar, some of you know Tibetan tradition, three main ways often that practice is delineated in terms of view, the view which is related to wisdom, in terms of meditation, secondly, and in terms of conduct, which is related to ethics. So very fundamental way of understanding training. And the key is that they're all interrelated. Now guess what's happened with Western Buddhism? It's generally, the focus has been on meditation. Again, for understandable reasons that are, I like to see a major reason is the fact that people were hungry for inner experience, and the Western contemplative traditions have been generally marginalized the last few centuries. Couldn't find them easily in churches, synagogues, and mosques, and so forth. And yet we've really focused on meditation and not so much on the others. And I think that's even a little more the case in insight meditation as compared to Zen or sometimes to Tibetan tradition, in large part because we have focused so much on retreats, but don't have residential centers so much. So it's even a little more heightened in those who practice insight meditation. It's interesting. And we can see this disconnection. It may be related that way that meditation is so much the focus in insight meditation, I think is connected with the way that mindfulness has been brought into the secular world and more or less, to a large extent, disconnected from ethics and from wisdom. So it becomes just this way of being present that helps you relax. You know, I remember I did this wonderful psychological training called the Hakomi training in body-based psychotherapy, a wonderful two-year training. And the way that mindfulness was presented in that training, it's a form of therapy which uses mindfulness. Here's what I was told. Find a partner. One of you will be the therapist. Mindfulness is the ability to know what's occurring in inner experience. You have 5 minutes to induce mindfulness in your client. That was the only explanation of mindfulness. And again, I love the training. You know, and I actually talked a lot with the trainers and gave them some further materials. Right? And we can see that, you know, again, it varies, but a lot of the secular use of mindfulness totally disconnects mindfulness from ethics and from wisdom. And it's been brought in, as you know, into all sorts of settings, including the military, law, you know, education, sports, psychotherapy, and so forth. And there's some issues there. Actually, in the Buddhist context, there is the focus, as I mentioned, on what's called right mindfulness. And what that means is that there is such a thing as wrong mindfulness. There's actually a technique, there's a term in the Pali language, Micca Sati. Sati is the word usually translated as mindfulness. Micca, M-I-C-C-H-A, would be translated as wrong mindfulness, and it's particularly the mindfulness in which the mindfulness is disconnected from the rest of the Eightfold Path. So a burglar can be very mindful. Dalai Lama was actually pretty concerned about this. There was a conference that some friends went to 4 or 5 years ago. He focused a lot on Micca Sati, wrong mindfulness. And he said, a terrorist can be really mindful. Right? And so I have a friend named David Loy. Some of you know his work. He's written quite a few quite wonderful books. He and Ron Purser, who lives in San Francisco and is a teacher, they wrote an essay about 5 years ago called McMindfulness. How many of you know that essay? Well, you can find it on the web. So it's McMindfulness, making the analogy to a form of mindfulness that is a little bit like, has the same relation to the depths of meditation as McDonald's has to great nutrition. Okay, and this is from the essay. It's making this point about the importance of connecting the three. Uncoupling mindfulness from its ethical and religious Buddhist context is understandable as an expedient move to make such training a viable product on the open market. But the rush to secularize and commodify mindfulness into a marketable technique may be leading to an unfortunate denaturing of the ancient practice, which is intended to be far more than relieving a headache, reducing blood pressure, or helping executives become better focused and more productive. While a stripped-down secularized technique may make it more palatable to the corporate world, decontextualizing mindfulness from its original liberative and transformative purpose, as well as its foundation in social ethics, amounts to a Faustian bargain. Rather than applying mindfulness as a means to awaken individuals and organizations from the unwholesome roots of greed, ill will, and delusion, it is usually being refashioned into a banal, therapeutic, self-help technique that can actually reinforce these roots.
Say that again.
It's basically saying that there's danger that the current ways of secularizing mindfulness may actually in some ways reinforce the roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. Yeah. And I think I mentioned maybe the first time that there's an interesting history of meditation techniques being used at times in connection with Japanese militarism and fascism in the first half of the 20th century. In large part, and again, I've mentioned I've been at ceremonies where Zen teachers apologize for losing our bearings, not having ethical bearings. Yeah. So if we take this interconnection seriously, what are some further ways to deepen our practice? And here, what I want to do particularly is to talk about how, in terms of non-harming, we can focus on the roots of non-harming in greed, hatred, and delusion. And so this is really having our non-harming practice not simply be about following the ethical precepts, but about going more deeply and looking, guided by a wisdom teaching, looking for the roots of what causes harming, which are greed, hatred, and delusion. So I want to spend time on each of these and talk about the relationship of each of the three, greed, hatred, and delusion, to harming, and then some ways that we can focus on each of the three and uproot greed and hatred and delusion. And this is, I think, a way to take what we've done so far and give like another perspective, really, that connects with what we've been doing, but it gives a little bit different window, and I think has the potential to take it yet deeper. Okay. So I think I want to start with hatred, but I thought I'd read something, because when we think of greed, hatred, and delusion, we think about what occurs in individuals, certainly, my greed, my hatred, and my delusion. But I think something that's important to see is that greed, hatred, and delusion aren't just about individuals. They can be about couples. I like the phrase in French, folie à deux. Do you know what that means? It means like more or less the madness of two. Right? And there can be greed, hatred, and delusion that's the property of couples, of families, of organizations, you know, and so forth. David Loy, in this great book called Money, Sex, War, Karma, which I'm positive was not his title. Subtitle, Notes for a Buddhist Revolution. So a very good book. And he, one of the most important parts of the book is when he talks about seeing greed, hatred, and delusion not just taking shape individually or in some of the ways I just mentioned, but also as being institutionalized. So when we think about greed, hatred, and delusion, it's helpful to think about them as also being institutionalized. He asked the question, do the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion, also operate collectively? Are there also collective greed, collective ill will, collective delusion? To ask the question this way is to realize the answer. Our present economic system institutionalizes greed. Our militarism institutionalizes ill will. And our corporate media institutionalized delusion. You could probably add to that, but there are other institutions. You know, I remember in terms of greed, it was a time of a fall in the stock market, and there was I remember a quote that was in the newspaper from a stockbroker. He says, at our stock market, there are only two cycles. One is a greed cycle, and one is a fear cycle. We are now in a fear cycle. Right? And so there's a certain way in which institutions can, you know, on a collective level, support greed. Same thing with, ill will or hatred and delusion. So when we talk about uprooting greed, hatred, and delusion, we want to talk both about individuals and about organizations and also about institutions and societies. So I'll start with hatred and ill will. And this seems like, when we start initially, this seems like the place to start if we're looking at harming, right? That wouldn't harming come out of ill will? Wouldn't it come out of hatred and negative feelings towards another? And again, or towards a whole group of people. It would come out of, you know, reactivity, some kind of aversion that becomes compulsive in the mind, right? And so we can see that kind of hurting, again, which might be there in the family, probably a lot of patterns of harming and ill will that get to become habits in families or habits in societies, right? We can see that. And there's often can be a lot of delusion there, a lot of ways. Yeah, can you hold it to till the end? Okay. And again, we could think of the tendency to shoot the second arrow. Something happens that I don't like, that I feel pain, and I immediately go back with pain. And so here, if we were practicing, we would want to work in a few different ways. Again, it can be helpful. If we're practicing non-harming, very clear that we'd want to work a lot with mindfulness. We'd want to look for instances of ill will. We'd want to study it. What's there? What's happening when I have ill will? We'd want to look at all the different forms that it takes. Verbal, you know, again, it can be just a sense of not liking. It can take the form that we've looked at times here, the judgmental mind, right? Negative views of someone else can easily manifest in harming. So we'd want to study all the forms of aversion. We want to be mindful of it. What's going on in the body? We'd want to, again, see some of the connections with long-term habits. You know, again, in the family, to go back to what's been raised, we would find tendencies and habits to harm on the basis of past harm that's been done, right? Typically, there's been some harm in the past, and that causes us to want to harm in the future. But it becomes ingrained at the level of habit and almost like a limiting belief and gets beneath consciousness. So it becomes habitual, and we could say is a form of delusion. So we also want to see where are the roots of that kind of harming in my own not knowing, my own not seeing. And we can, again, we can see a lot of that happening at the level of social dynamics. We can see the way that in history there are these forms of harming that often occur through massive delusion. Again, a few weeks ago, going twice to the African American History and Culture Museum and seeing the history of the United States and just seeing how much harming was done by people who were clearly fooling themselves, thinking that they were ethical and following the Constitution, but were doing things which harmed a whole group of people in massive ways under slavery and Jim Crow. And it's really striking just to see person after person from, whatever, Thomas Jefferson on through various politicians up to the present. A kind of delusion there, right? Thinking that they were being ethical, that they were following the Declaration of Independence and so forth. So a kind of contradiction or lie, which is really a kind of delusion. So we can see how that harming comes out of that. You know, or I think related to our times, you know, some, I think I might have mentioned it last time, but the fact that the, you know, the justification for Japanese internment, it's come to light, was on national security grounds. And a lot of harm was done. And yet the government at that time did national security analysis and found that there were no national security grounds. But they carried out the policy for political reasons. Very parallel to our time, and it's well documented that immigrants have lower levels of crime and actually are a boon to the country, right? So it's not being done on the basis of reality. It's being done on the basis of politics or political kowtowing to certain groups, right? It's delusion. There's a kind of delusion there that's connected with harming very commonly socially and I think individually. When we look at greed, and I should say also that, you know, we can practice. Of course, we can practice, as we mentioned earlier, if there's ill will or aversion, we can do the heart practices, loving kindness, compassion, forgiveness, and so forth can make a big impact. We look to the second root, greed, and we can really very similarly, look more deeply at greed, look more deeply at the wanting, at the grasping. Right? We can practice more with letting go. Letting go of that, those words I was going to say, right? That's a kind of letting go of when we pause or we don't say something. We can study the wanting. We can see that when I want something very much, it might be very hard for me to be empathic towards another. That the wanting can blind me. So I don't see clearly, I have certain delusion. Of course, there's tremendous greed in our society, right? To, you know, where people want more and more. And of course, you all know the statistics of, you know, I mean, I think inequality is partly a measure of significant greed, right? So you have figures, I had 1% of the population control 40% of the wealth. 60% of the population live on 2.3% of the wealth. Right? These are figures. So we can be mindful. We can really study, what is greed like? What is wanting like? What's my mind like when I really want something? Whether it's something material, something in terms of a relationship, whatever it is, something spiritual. And from time to time, I think I've mentioned that some time ago, I organized a class with Diana Winston on greed management. That was our title. We were both really interested in a class on greed management. We offered it. Very few people were interested, but we were. And so we actually had 5 people took the class. We had 2 teachers. And we loved it. We really loved, it was tremendous inquiry. I had never looked, we spent 5 weeks looking at greed. You know, and I think I've mentioned, if I've talked about it, I mentioned that we had a final exam the last week. We went through a newly opened Bed, Bath, and Beyond and did silent walking meditation. You know, I found myself wanting things that before going into the Bed, Bath, and Beyond, I didn't even know existed. The thing that I remember was like a tray on your television set so you can store more things. You know, but there were all sorts of, you know, they had things I had never known existed that one could want. Right? And so when we actually looked at greed, we found it had very clear characteristics. When there's greed in the mind, this is something to study. Each of us, can we study when there's wanting? Again, this is this interconnection. Non-harming is the guideline, and we can see how does harming have a root in greed. And then we can look at greed when it appears in the mind. What does it look like? What occurs? What we found when there was... greed, there were a few things. There were that there was a certain compulsive quality in the mind. The mind had to have something. It wasn't a matter of measured reflection. It was compulsive. It was also extremely self-centered. There was very little consideration of others at all when there was greed. So think of an economic system rooted in greed. Very little consideration of other people. Right? So self-centeredness, lack of consideration of others, almost no sense of consequences. Right? When there is, see if these resonate. When there is greed in the mind, almost no sense of consequences. Sometimes we found there was a sense of entitlement. Like, I should have this. Right? And so what practices help us with this? Clearly, mindfulness can be very helpful to have a study greed. You know, study it when it appears. When there's some kind of wanting, look into what's there. You can study this for a week, right? Study or for 2 weeks. Say, I'm going to really study greed. What's it like? Do your own study and come to your own version of the conclusions that we had in our 5-week greed class. I think we gave people a certificate at the end that they graduated from grief management class. May have been the only time that a grief management class has ever been offered in the history of the universe. I haven't heard of it occurring, but you can offer it. So we can do the mindfulness practice. We can also, again, really, with all of these, the practices are really going to be twofold. On the one hand, study the greed, hatred, delusion. On the other hand, develop qualities which counter it, which counter the quality. So we look into it with mindfulness, and then we also develop practices like gratitude, thankfulness. We develop generosity, which goes against greed. We develop simplicity, maybe a simpler life. We look at our own needs. And again, there are many ways we can work with the social dimension. So I think, again, what you can see how in all of these, we're guided by a wisdom teaching. It influences our practice of non-harming, and there are meditative ways that we can work with it and deepen. So you can see the how this is so much beyond simply following a precept in some simple behavioral way. That's really the point of the talk. Then lastly, good old delusion or ignorance. You know, I mean, in many of the teachings, ignorance is the core issue. And I realized that, you know, the talk series that I gave the last time I was here before this series, I gave a few talks on things are not as they appear, right? That was about delusion, right? And so we could actually take the next year and very profitably study delusion. There are just so many dimensions of it. So here we can see that, again, the teachings are that of these three so-called poisons, in some ways delusion is most fundamental. That is our ignorance, particularly about the nature of things and the nature of our own being, the nature of our minds. That confuses us. We think that we're separate. We think that following our own wishes and gaining pleasures and avoiding pain is the way to the deepest happiness. This is delusive. It's not right, right? But we live that way. You know, we're habituated that way. And we are not really in touch with our deeper nature of love, wisdom, and compassion. Or we're not that much in touch with it a lot of the time. Maybe we are sometimes. And so it's said, again, often said, that when we're not deluded, harming another being is as unthinkable as the left hand harming the right hand. It's a nice metaphor. That when we are actually non-deluded, harming is unthinkable. Harming another being is unthinkable as part of our body harming another part, like the left hand harming the right hand. In the core teachings, I think we've explored this at times, the delusion is especially about seeing things as permanent that are really impermanent. Thinking that grasping and pushing away will bring happiness rather than suffering. And thinking that we're a separate self, that I am fundamentally separate from others, rather than seeing our interdependence and seeing our deep connection. And of course, we have tremendous number of delusions, as I mentioned earlier, about all sorts of things socially. You know, there's a wonderful documentary on race titled Race, the History or the Future of an Illusion. Illusion, yeah. It was a very good documentary from about 15 years ago, some of which I think is on YouTube. And it treats it as a kind of illusion. Of course, you know, race has no scientific basis. It's a socially constructed category which causes great harm and doesn't really refer to any fundamental reality. That's good to know, right? The social construct is all too real, of course. right? But it's good to know that it's at a certain level, it's purely delusive, and yet it structures life. So what practices to do? Again, we want to be mindful. Now, being mindful of delusion is harder than being mindful of greed and hatred or ill will, right? So what do we do? This is where we sometimes need to follow a trail where we find the harming, the ill will, and the greed. And we need to look, are there habitual patterns beneath it? Are there habitual patterns in my family? We can see these in ourselves. A lot of times formed early in our lives, we can call these limiting beliefs that are a form of delusion. We don't see clearly because we have these underlying habits. These are hard to look at, hard to find. And so again, when I've worked with the judgment work here and elsewhere, we try to follow the trail of the judgmental mind as a way to go deeper and see the structures of delusion. We can do that. If we follow any form of harming deeply enough, we will get to the underlying habits and underlying beliefs, which are often not present to consciousness. Not easy. So we can use mindfulness. Again, we can develop the wisdom practices. We can particularly watch our thinking and watch our minds. And there are other practices which are more advanced, which can help us see where we're deluded. Again, not so straightforward as just, we can easily track greed and hatred. If I asked you, track delusion for the next week. It's like the famous Donald Rumsfeld quote. He says, there are known knowns, but there are also unknown unknowns. I won't go further. He was using that to try to justify the fact that we, even though there's no evidence of weapons of mass destruction, they might be there. Anyway, but the idea is that it's hard to see what we don't know, right? And so we need some strategies. Anyway, I could go further, but I want to give a little time for a discussion. I just want to close with sort of, again, seeing these different ways that we've looked at deepening ethical practice. That's really what this is all about. Can we deepen it here, particularly by seeing the interconnection of the guidance by wisdom and the support by meditative training of non-harming? So it's not, again, not simply about some more superficial following of rules, but it's a deep inquiry into these roots. So I'll close with two quotations. One is from the Buddha. Purify the starting point of wholesome states. What is the starting point of wholesome states? Virtue that is well purified, and view, that means the wisdom, that is straight. Then, practitioner, when your virtue is well purified and your view straight based on virtue, established on virtue, then you should develop mindfulness. You can hear that interconnection. And then closing with Thich Nhat Hanh, aware of the suffering caused by the destruction of life, I vow to cultivate compassion and learn ways to protect the lives of people, animals, plants, and minerals. I am determined not to kill, not to let others kill, and not to condone any act of killing or harming in the world, in my thinking, and in my way of life. That's our direction. Thank you. I took a little more time than I wanted, but I think we can still maybe have time for one or two questions. Yeah, Tom, just you, the two here.
I'm aware that in our culture, and also in my family, humor is barbed. It's kind of what makes it funny, I think, for a lot of the culture, and certainly a lot of my family. It's barbed, it's a little hurt,
yep.
inflicted, and you're supposed to respond by, you know, inflicting it back. And I'm becoming mindful of that and doing it less and not responding by harm
yep.
back. And it seems like as a result of kind of taking that path of non-harming, I become the target more often. I become, I'm an easy target for
yeah.
more of that.
Yeah, yeah. So you're being ready for advanced practice, Tom. So two points about it. I think there were two things that struck me. One is that there can be, the Buddha did not talk about passive aggression. Right, in which we masquerade harming to make it look like it's not harming. Right? That's what you're talking about. Humor can be that, other forms of so-called passive aggression. Right, and so it's something really to look out for. It's a form of, maybe a form of delusion as well, that there, you know, even the person thinks I'm not really harming, or I was just joking. Right, you know, don't you have a sense of humor? Right? And then the second point is there's a way in which when there is a system sort of a mutual conflict or mutual harming, if one of the participants disengages, there can be some resentment about that and some anger that you're not playing the old game. Maybe, you know, maybe even that you think you're better. So it's understandable. Yeah. Maybe last one, just up. Right in front of you. Okay.
I have a question
sure.
that keeps coming up for me over and over. I don't... the investigation into greed, hate, delusion is guided by wisdom practices.
A little closer.
Is guided by wisdom practices.
Yeah.
Why isn't it guided by compassion practices? It seems that heart, the crux, call it what you will, is the heart.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and why don't we start there?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that's a helpful comment. It really points towards a clarification of what I was saying. That I was talking about the teaching of the roots of the three poisons. Being greed, hatred, delusion, that could be called a wisdom teaching, right? Now, we can be guided by that. What's my motivation? My motivation might well be compassion, and almost certainly is. So I can be guided by a wisdom teaching, but my motivation, it comes from the heart, and is compassion.
That's where virtue.
What?
That's where virtue lives, so to speak, is...
Virtue in the
respond in a caring or a not caring way.
Yeah, the virtue in the quote that I just gave is a synonym for ethics. Yeah, but the way in ordinary English we would talk about compassion as a virtue. Yeah, but I think it's a good point. Like, what's the motivation here? It's usually a mixture of motivation really to see clearly, and a motivation to help. And as things develop, those two join, so that, you know, ultimately there's no separation between being motivated by wanting to know the way things are and wanting to help others. And so thank you. It really helped me bring out that point a little more clearly than I had given it. Thank you.
Thank you.